Welcome to the RNZ Musical Chairs. Nigel Russell is an Auckland-based musician of considerable pedigree. Passionate about all genres of music, from a young age, Nigel has performed live and recorded with a bunch of bands, including as a young punk back in the late 70s, The Spelling Mistakes, whose single Feels So Good went top 30. After their demise in 1980, Nigel was a vocalist with Auckland post-punk band Dance Macabre, recording an EP Between the Lines and an album Last Request for Reaction Records. Nigel's developing passion for synthesizers continued with the Car Crash Set, collaborating with the late David Bulog. Car Crash Set released a couple of top 40 EPs and an album and played live for most of the 80s and 90s and now the 2020s. Much of the band's material was released in Europe by the German label Analog Records, where it's been well received. Welcome, Nige. How's Kuiper Harbour?
Yeah. Lovely at this time of the year. A little windy, though.
As long as I've known you, you've always lived and breathed music, which kind of begs the question, when did music first start resonating with you as a kid?
Oh, God. I think we used to watch Come On as kids. And see all that sort of stuff on the telly in the 60s. And, it's just kind of grew from there, essentially.
So by the time you started your education at Salem College, how involved were you in music?
I'd done sort of choir work and, you know, musical theatre at schools and things like that through. Didn't really have any formal music education as such, though I did a couple of sort of interest papers in third and fourth form. Third and fourth, maybe fifth even.
So singing in choirs, that must have been a good starting point for you.
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
in terms of confidence and delivery. Well,
yeah, absolutely. I think in that respect, definitely. I mean, material-wise, it was a bit straight compared, but definitely a confidence thing.
So would you say that was a catalyst to actually giving you the confidence to be a sort of frontman, a vocalist?
I definitely think it helped, you know. I don't think I'm the greatest frontman, but by the same token, you know, I'm not shy about singing, shall we say, you know.
Yeah, it's attitude's got a lot to do with it. Body on, so sensitive and I can really criticise the way you live and I can really tell. And I can give you all the lip I have to give. I don't know why, but it feels so good. I don't know why, but it feels so good. I don't know why, but it feels so good. So good. So good. So good. Your first recording band you hooked up with was The Spelling Mistakes. Tell us, who came up with the name Spelling Mistakes and how briefly did the band sort of get together and pull together a repertoire?
Spelling Mistakes was an entity that existed before I joined. So they'd been going 3 or 4 months. I had a band at Selwyn and we supported the Spelling Mistakes at the HQ Rock Cafe in Upper Queen Street. And the singer from Spelling Mistakes, Nick Hansen, had been a year ahead of me at Selwyn, so we knew one another.
Yeah.
And I think Nick and Julian had been
brothers.
They'd been in a band called Get Smart. Warwick had been in the Aliens and the Atrocities.
What was Warwick's second name?
De punk was Warwick Hitler.
Oh, okay.
Those bands had been Zwine's bands, mm-hmm. And Zwine's was a sort of a. Was a club that was operating, you know, was a all ages club, punk club in the old Bluestone building in Durham Lane.
Yeah, yeah.
And the bands would sort of form out of the remnant, you know, they'd go play for a few months and then break up, and then something else would form out of different bands that had broken up, and that's essentially how Spelling Mistakes happened.
What was the dynamic within the Spelling Mistakes? Because you were blessed with quite an extroverted frontman who could, I suspect, attract trouble but kind of get away with it.
Yeah, and I think that's when we were sort of really hitting our stride was as the whole sort of Boot Boy thing was happening in Auckland as well. And Proud Scum, who had another one of the Zwine's bands, who'd been the Boot Boy Darlings, had moved to Australia, so we essentially inherited their audience, for better or worse. So, yeah, that would make things fairly precious at times. You know, we had a gig at St Helier's RSA, which made the front page of the Herald the following day. It's been a riot in the street outside. Venues would would be regularly trashed, you know, so, and we wouldn't get invited back. So
that makes it difficult career move.
Yeah, it was. It got to basically what really spelt the demise of the band was that it got to a point where there were only two venues in Auckland we could play, and that was Main Street and Excess. And yeah, you really couldn't do that for the rest of your days.
Right.
So, and I think rumour had it, there was also, we had a thing, there was a thing called Team Police or whatever it was at the time that used to come around and rumble the pubs. Word was that they had put out a directive to pub owners that anybody that employed us under our name or any other name would stand to have their licence revoked.
You recorded a couple of singles, yep. Feels So Good, possibly the most well-known track. Were there other recordings?
Yeah, there was another one that came out prior to Feels So Good called Rena. I won't go into the rest of it.
Yeah,
if you know, you know.
Yeah.
But that came out on Ripper Records, and it was a split A-side, should I say, with The Plague. No, The Whiz Kids.
It was a big deal going into the studio back then to record. Who was paying the studio bills, and what did those records achieve, do you reckon?
The Feels So Good was done as it was offered as a prize for the Battle at Windsor Castle Battle of the Bands.
Okay.
And it was a 2-day thing at the Windsor over a Labour weekend or something, I forget which. And word is it was rigged for us.
I heard that. through the grapevine.
I can neither confirm nor deny that one. But essentially the prize money from that was used to do what became Rev 2, which was the second release for Propeller Records.
Okay. And so you switched from Brian Staff to Simon Grigg.
Yeah, that's
Simon Grigg was a judge, right?
Oh, yeah, he was, as was Barry Jenkin, who was, you know, supporting the band. And, you know, it was, yeah, a whole bunch of... what could possibly have been... Yeah, how people possibly think that could have happened.
Yeah.
So, yeah, essentially that afforded us the money to go into the studio and do Feel So Good. And we had one day to record that, and we had Faint Floors produced.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and then we did a B-side, which was 2 tracks, and that was sort of banged out pretty quickly as well.
Right.
And then subsequently we went in and did demo recordings for what was going to be our second release, but the band called it a day before that
right.
eventuated.
Looking back on it, do you think today's bands have it easier given the technology to record is pretty much...
Oh, yeah, most definitely. I think the whole recording process has been democratised significantly.
Big time.
Yeah, in the last 20 years. And, you know, that, I think, you could track that back down to computers and the cost of memory, you know, as the cost of, you know, buying a hard disk has gotten cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. You know, where you can buy a, you know, 2-terabyte disk now for $100, then it's, you know, you can record to your heart's content on that stuff for next to nothing, you know.
So back then, getting into the studio was actually quite... to the moon.
In the same way, you know, if you were writing a book, you know, same thing, you had editors and all the rest of it. You had to get past that gateway, and then, you know, all your footnotes and all the rest of it had to be checked so the publishers wouldn't be sued and so on and so forth. And the same with recording, you know. I mean, the actual cost of the gear, the cost of tape, engineers, that all that time that was involved in doing it, in a lot of cases you only had X amount of dollars to spend, and you did what you could in the time.
Yeah,
I mean they would do deals as well, you know. So it was you could go. I think back in the day it was a couple of $100, and you get a day if you're an up and coming band. And Harlequin was the other studio at the time in Albert Street, Doug Rogers' place.
That's right.
And same sort. He would run, you know, in downtime type weekends or an overnight special, you know, and you could do that.
A lot of history has gone underneath that car park where it currently used to be.
Well, you know, it was where the Beatles stayed, you know, the DB Royal International. Yeah,
oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And levelled for a car park a couple of days before the crash of the 80s.
That's right.
And it's been a car park ever since.
I could be wrong, but it could be quite a heavy scene when you guys were gigging out in the pub circuit back then.
Well, yeah, as I say, I mean, the whole boot boy thing was a, sort of had a life of its own, really. It had started, I think, originally it based around Zwines, and because Zwines was above a disco. So to get up and round the corner, you had to run the gamut of the disco guys who didn't like punks. So, you know, they'd puff out and bash a few. So you'd have to time your run to get round there, and, you know, the Boot Boys turned up to sort of protect the punks, in inverted commas, and it just kind of scaled from there. And it was quite a different movement. You know, it was a lot of Māori guys as well, you know. It wasn't quite the white supremacist sort of thing that we associate with that movement these days.
Right.
So, and then there was the Boot Girls, which was, yeah, possibly even more frightening.
Lord. So yeah. When and why did the spelling mistakes call it a day?
Well, pretty much it became untenable, really. We couldn't play anywhere short of organising our own shows or doing Main Street or Excess. Mm-hmm. And, you know, none of the pubs would have us. I think our one headlining gig at a pub was at the Station Hotel, and the Station Hotel had these two big glass, you know, that reinforced glass doors, front doors, you know, about 2 metres tall. And someone managed to smash those. So,
wow.
Yeah, you know, so that was pretty much the end of it.
How long before you ran into the other guys in your next band, Dance Macabre?
Probably 3 or 4 months. I scuffed around. I had had jammed with the Ainsworths on stage, who were on one of the Propeller compilation albums with Hilary Hunt.
Yeah.
They had a sort of a Mimi's association. And then basically I answered an ad and Rip It Up, and it turned out that Wes Prince, the guitarist and main songwriter for, at that stage, they were called the Cadets.
Oh, yeah.
He and I had been at primary school together, so there was that relationship.
Oh, okay.
And, yeah, we kind of just developed from there. Auditioned and as a singer-synthesist, and went from there.
So when you say synthesis, we're talking about very much the prototypes for what we have today.
Very much. I mean, that back in the day, you know, synths were jolly expensive.
Mm.
And at a school camp, one of the student teachers had brought along a Mini Moog. And
oh, really?
Yeah. This had mucked around with one of those. And
that would have been about the price of a house.
Small Greyland villa at the time, you know. And they're probably worth almost as much now. But, so mucked around with that, and then had become very interested in the path that what we were hearing out of the UK at that stage, with bands like the Early Human League, The Normal, Thomas Lear, all these, Throbbing Gristle, you know, and it was almost as if after the first wave of punk had happened, there was almost like a right turn with people who had taken that ethos that, you know, you can do it, you know, you don't have to be a musician or skilled or whatever,
right?
And had grabbed what were the first of the cheap synths that were starting to come through, right? And had applied that ideology to that equipment. And yeah,
I used to enjoy your repertoire because I'd previously been living in London and regularly tuning into John Peel and getting that week's NME and Melody Maker and seeing those bands that the papers were touting. Given it took about 6 months for the latest NME or Melody Maker to get here to New Zealand, how was Dance Macabre sourcing material that influenced you?
Well, that's a funny one too, because I think RTC Records in New Zealand, which had the license for Virgin,
that's right,
were very proactive, and they had it was a double album that sold for $2.99.
Oh, okay.
And it was basically just a sampler of all of the Virgin catalogue at the time, and that
smart move.
And that was everything from Sex Pistols through to Tangerine Dream with a bit of Mike Oldfield and a bunch of their signings. So, yeah. You know, we would mail order things out of the, you know, you'd see single of the week in NME or something like that, albeit 3 months late. You know, you'd pop down to the post office, buy your postal note, you know, fill your selection and, you know, clip the coupon and send it to the UK, and then, you know, a month or two later it would arrive by service mail.
Yeah.
And we used to bring a lot of records like that. Yeah, just I've still got a few of them, some of the, you know, the early Devo singles, and by that stage we'd also had met Barry Jenkins, who was basically the New Zealand John Peel. Mm-hmm. And we used to go and visit Barry on air and bring in stuff that we'd bought in and play it and stuff like that and things. So we were hearing that as well, you know. So
in this digital age, it's possibly hard for some younger listeners to actually appreciate how to hear some of this stuff.
Yeah. Oh, you tell the kids today and they won't believe you.
And John Peel, of course, played Dance for Carl.
Well, that was a funny one. I never believed it. You know, I thought, oh, yeah, it's only a rumour, you know.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until someone in the last couple of years has released a book, which is all his weekly playlists.
Yeah.
And there it is. And I couldn't believe it.
Brilliant.
True. Still don't know where to start. You were a vision restored.
You recorded a great EP called Between the Lines for Reaction Records, the Mandel Studios in-house label, who also employed some pretty hard-working engineers in weekend downtime. They were very creative sessions.
Yes. Well, with Macabre, we sort of took advantage of the $200 deal at Harlequin and did a three-song demo there. And then I think that's beyond that, I think you'd just come back to NZ. I think you came and saw us at the Reverb Room up in which was our spiritual home, because our rehearsal space used to be in the basement of the Takeaway Bar next door.
Yep, I went down there twice.
Which is very handy, because they used to have a lift at the back of the building, so you could just chuck all your gear on and take it up the lift rather than up the stairs. And we'd just wheel it out of the rehearsal room onto the lift and away we went. And I think at that stage you saw something in us or saw some potential and invited us to do a live to two-track demo at
Mandrel. Yeah.
And I think we were rejected. But
I don't think it was me that rejected.
No, but it wasn't you. It wasn't you, I don't think. No, because you lobbied for us. And I think it was, well, all right, they can be your pet project and I'll look after the Mockers or something.
I'd bought them as well, so it was a kind of a trade-off.
Yeah, exactly. And I think Glenn sort of saw more pop potential.
Oh, definitely.
With them, and I don't really think he got Macabre.
No. I just really loved your repertoire, because you were doing some really cool covers as well.
Yeah, we did Shack Up. Well, the version we knew was the Certain Ratio one.
That's right. It used to get good crowds.
Oh, no, we did. It was going pretty well, actually. I mean, it went, we did a show at the first Sweetwaters on the aerial railway stage.
That's right,
and that sort of put some wind in our sails. And then on the eve of our first show at Main Street headlining, or the first show at Main Street, actually, our bass player at that stage had a little run-in with the law, and that was the end of that. So we had to recruit another bass player in short time and, you know, basically try and maintain the momentum, and got Ralph Crump on board.
Yeah.
And Ralph brought sort of quite a melodic bass playing style to the band, he's, I guess, a bit sort of Peter Hookish in a way.
He was.
He's up the fretboard as opposed to down the other end. Yeah, it was basically with him on board, it just sort of really took off.
And you had a very fine drummer too.
Yeah, Rod was fantastic. Yeah, exactly.
He was good.
It just went. I think we sort of burnt very brightly, very quickly, for a very short time.
Esteemed renegade sort of radio DJ Barry Jenkin was a fan, and as one can see in the video, there's a cool instrumental called Web, which is on YouTube, which involves a bit of flying around. Barry's a pilot as well.
That's right.
Didn't he fly you around to Christchurch?
That was we did a show in Christchurch with Herco Pilots, which was
my brother
Harry Ratbag's band, and Arms for Children.
Right.
It ended up being christened the Trains, Planes and Automobile Tour because Wes and I and most of Macabre took the back line in a transit van from Auckland to Christchurch, drove.
Yeah.
And managed to squeeze ourselves and a PA and everything else into the van.
Luxury,
mate. It was. And I think the a couple of Hercos and an Arms for Kids flew with Barry Jenkin and the Cessna to Christchurch, and then the rest of them caught the night trains from Auckland to Wellington and then Wellington to Christchurch. And then we did shows at the Gladstone down there.
Which was probably run by Jim Wilson.
It was run by Jim, yeah. I've still got some letters from Jim, with the booking details and things. And then on the Friday night, we went to a party out in Beeley Ave and had all our gear stolen out of the van.
And, that's right, I remember that.
So that left us in an interesting situation. It was also at the height of the Springbok tour as well. So, you know, the cops were otherwise
engaged.
But fortunately, we did a radio appeal and sort of put the word out, and miraculously, instruments and backline reappeared in time to play that night. But, you know, things like cameras and, you know, some of that other stuff, we never got back. So
I think quite a few in the music community kind of rallied around at that point.
Pretty much, yeah. I think there was potential to borrow gear if stuff hadn't turned up.
And they did a couple of benefit concerts as well.
No, that was another. That was the next theft.
Tell us about the next.
Well, the next one we did a tour with Penknife Glides, which coincided with the release of Between the Lines, and I think the Glides had Sound of Drums.
Yeah.
That EP of theirs, and we did a run. It was all over the show. Started in Hamilton, and then played in Whangarei, and then Christchurch, and.
I know. It's well sorted out. Well,
thanks, Chris Parr. then Dunedin, back to Christchurch, Lower Hutt, Hastings and Gisborne. And then we got back to Auckland, and Wes and Rod, I think, and Ralph were decompressing at the station hotel one day, came out and the van was gone with everything in it.
Oh, Lord.
So
that was pretty much the end of...
Almost. There was definitely a sort of a rallying round of the bands. There was a fundraiser played at Main Street, and we got some money back towards gear and things like that. We had a booking for Sweetwaters on the main stage the following summer, and played with borrowed gear on that. And yeah, managed to limp through the rest of that year, I think. And we were at that stage had started recording Last Request, which became our last thing.
Yeah.
But it just kind of was just getting harder and harder. And I'd gone away to Rarotonga for a couple of weeks to as an extra for Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence,
starring David Bowie
and Ryuichi Sakamoto. Yeah, and came back, and by that stage they'd all it was all over pretty much. So yeah. I think we managed to mix what was left, and that became Last Request.
Yeah, and it's a good little band, really.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we've reformed and done two shows in the last 20 years. We did one in 2008, yeah. And then Penknife Glides wanted to do it all over again in 2013, so invited us to play with them. How can you deceive me with your lies and silly games? Sorry to treat you like this, but there seems no other way. When you cast your eyes upon me, I didn't want to show just how much I really need you, so don't let me go. So it wasn't too long before you embarked on your next band. How did Car Crash Set come together? Well, like most people, it was very hard to make actually a living in music at that time. So
Still is,
yeah. So I had a day job working in a music store. Right. And the music store I was at was probably, it was a real hub for Auckland.
It was Kingsley Smith.
It was the hip store, and since we're really becoming affordable at that stage, mm-hmm. I had met Dave Burlog. He was in a band called Stranger Upstairs, playing guitar, and they had supported us a couple of times at Reverb Room. Mm-hmm. He'd also bought a Roland guitar synth from me when I was working my previous day job, which was working for the guy that was bringing in Roland into New Zealand at that stage. So we hooked up again through the shop, and there was another guy who bought a synth from me, a guy called Nick Jenkins.
Oh, yeah.
Thought, well, let's see what we can come up with, and started jamming, basically. Managed to get some material together, did a demo at Progressive Music Studios, which was run by Terry King, yeah. And Terry had been our sound man in Dance Macabre. So yeah, it was natural to go and work with him again. Then one of the tracks from that was picked up by Propeller for one of their compilations, We'll Do Our Best. Class of 81 was the one, and then that was the one after that, yeah. So we had a track on that. Then Nick up sticks and went back to the UK, and it's just sort of Dave and I, and it was kind of, wasn't really sure where it was going to go. And at that stage I had a call from Andrew Snoid, or Nee McLennan, mm-hmm. And he was in the throes of setting up Coconut Rough, and invited me to come along, have a muck around with that. And I think he needed more of a keyboard player than a one-figure synth player,
right.
To be honest. Not long after, after that, Dave rang me and said, oh, look, I've booked a session at Larry Killip's studio, which was Genesis. Got an idea for a track. Should we come in and do it? So I joined him there, and that became the beginnings of the first Car Crash Set track, which is Fall From Grace. Is this the last time I'll ever see your eyes? You search for something, it's too hard to find.
Gem of a song.
Absolutely, I think probably one of our best. It's gained recognition internationally over the years as well. We then took that to you, at Reaction, you were sufficiently interested to engage us to come along to do some more. That became our relationship with Reaction Records, and we recorded Outsider, which, so those two, Fall From Grace and Outsider, became our first single, two songs.
Gem of a single.
Yeah, we just carried on from there, essentially. And, I mean, Mandrill would do the whole Reaction thing was, it was a studio, full proper studio during the day, doing commercial work. Mm-hmm. And, if you were, Pink Flamingos or Street Talk or, one of the bands that had a budget, you got to record during the day. And if you were like us, who had no budget, you got in after hours and
weekends
and public holidays and things like that. And great idea, really, because, essentially your hard costs are really only the cost of tape, the electricity and the engineer, whatever comes out of that, you could have come up with a real gem.
I think it's quite pertinent to sort of point out that it was quite an ordeal back then, because it was a time to actually get the technology to talk to each other, because it was a time MIDI hadn't quite entered the equation.
Yeah.
Was it frustrating for the technology, waiting for the technology to catch up?
Well, not actually knowing that the technology was ever going to catch up. MIDI happened in, MIDI stands for Musical Instrument Digital Interface, and it was prior to MIDI appearing on the scene. Different brands of synths couldn't talk to one another.
Yeah.
There were two formats. There's a thing called control voltage and gate, and then there's there were two different formats that those two worked at. And all the Roland stuff worked on one, all the Korg and Yamaha stuff and worked on another.
Yeah.
And then you had the Moogs and the Oberheims and the Prophets, which were just, stupid money. This is $5,000 or $6,000 for a poly synth, and this was back in 82, and you could have bought a Villa in Grey Lynn for $50,000, so it's kind of new synth or a villa, somewhere to live.
The band achieved quite a bit, much of it courtesy of Mandrill. Good people coming and going within the band, and especially word of mouth. There were times when it was like Car Crash grew into a sort of 10-piece band at one stage.
I think we did actually hit 10 for one show. So basically, as we were recording, we would invite guests in. So I had a relationship with Ryan Monger, who was the bass player in Artijar.
Yep.
And Artijar at that stage were basically a
South Auckland covers band.
Yeah, exactly. And I knew Ryan through the shop. Of course, slap bass was the thing at the time, and Ryan was all over that. So he came in and played on our third single, Breakdown. And then, Rod from Macabre played some drums on some tracks. You were playing guitar for us by that stage as well, and
Horn section.
Well, that came later. Yeah, that horn section came with the EP. So,
that's right.
Yeah, we weren't really playing that often either. So we'd play maybe once or twice a year.
Yeah.
So that basically each time we played, you'd actually would have had time to write some new songs. So it also made each time you did play more of an event, and you could hype it up a bit harder, rather than, they're playing the Windsor this week. Oh, we won't go to the Windsor this week because they'll be at Main Street or something the following, So I think we were maybe three or four times a year tops,
I also quite liked the fact back then that you could sort of do three nights in a row sometimes, like at the Windsor or places like that.
Just leave everything set up.
I love those things.
Pretty much,
It was also quite a visual band because your brother, Harry Ratbag, was designing stage sets for us.
We got more and more sort of
that's right. Involved.
Bits of Dixon shelving and, we used scaff pipe and scaffolding and all sort of stuff, and they would actually build the synth stand into the structure. So,
it was brilliant.
It was great fun.
Yeah. Some of those recording sessions at Mandrill were super sessions, and so much that they took pretty much an entire weekend.
Yeah. The one thing with Mandrill, though, it was that don't blow the monitors.
Because
the studio monitors, they used to have the fuses on them were light bulbs, and if you pumped it a bit too hard, you could potentially blow that bulb, And as we discovered, the light bulb was actually a VW tail light from a Beetle.
Okay.
And of course, if you're in there over the weekend, this is, again, kids, Auckland stopped on Saturday at 12 o'clock. Saturday shopping, there was no all-day shopping, no all-day Sundays.
Yeah.
And there was only one auto parts shop down Dominion Road, Sedgerton, that you could potentially get down and maybe get some bulbs from if they were still open.
Car Crash Sat managed to score some good support gigs as well. Tell us about what you remember of playing with Shriekback, Hunters and Collectors, Orchestra Maneuvers, and there were probably others as well.
No, it's just we did two runs with Shriekback, and they came through, and at that stage, Reaction was being distributed by Festival, and Simon Bayetz, who was the... Was he A&R Festival? Or
Pretty much.
So Simon was a big supporter of both Macabre and Car Crash Sat, and saw that there was the support going for that. And I think Doug bought them out as part of Looney Tours, should I say.
Doug Hood, yeah.
Yeah, so we did the Auckland shows with them, which were great, at the Galaxy, which is now the power station.
Yeah.
And then they came back through, maybe was it 6 months or a year later? At that stage, we were mid-recording what was going to be our last record, which never actually eventuated, and invited them in to, we're in the studio this weekend, you want to come in and have a play? So guitarists turned up, the drummer and the backing singers. So they appear on that track.
Which never got released.
Which never got released. Last EP that we did, Dave had gone over to the UK for 6 months OE, and whilst he was there, he said, "Oh, can you send me the master tapes or the 2-inch for a couple of tracks on this record? I've just booked a session at Blackwing Studios."
John Fryer.
Yeah. And Blackwing was also they did a lot of Mute stuff and all the stuff for. I mean, the Cocteau Twins were recording there, the Small Coil album was done there. So, yeah, Dave had booked a session there, got John Fryer to mix this track for us, East and West. You know, we, of course, had to wait for the cassette to arrive in the post, slapped it on the machine, it was just jaws dropped. It was...
fantastic.
Was that us? Did we play that? I think it must have been one of the very first, you know, UK remixes of a New Zealand band.
Yeah.
And so we were quite excited about the whole thing, and then sent the rest of the record, which was, I think, was a four tracker. And John waved his magic wand over that and mixed it all for us. But very interesting, he would only mix 30-second segments and just do bits and bolt it all together again at the end.
Yeah.
But circling back to that Shrekback thing, that then went back to John as well. So that finally got mixed in again at Blackwing. Then, I think through one thing and another, it just the band just kind of just petered out and it folded and it never really saw the light of day.
You must miss Dave, who passed away in October 2021 at Auckland Hospital. He was a unique guy and a serious music gear guy, an addict really. Tell us about working and hanging out with Dave.
Well, we hooked up again in... Gosh, I think it must have been 2016.
Yeah.
We kind of went our separate ways in about 87, and then you and I reconvened, and you had Greg Johnson, who was on the run from This Boy Rob, which I think had done an EP for you at Pagan. Here I'm stuck on an island, and I couldn't care less. If you can't get on with each other, this is a myth. Well, they're all in the buildings, and you hide behind walls. Tell me how many days now before this city falls. So Greg was songwriter for hire, or, you know, loose. And you introduced us, and you came in as guitar, and then I think Greg brought Joost in, Joost Langveld, on bass. So we just carried on, and I did two and a half albums with Greg. I think I left sort of halfway through Vine Street. But Dave and I basically had, you know, got on with our lives. At that stage, I had started work at Oceania Audio, which is a PA rental company in Auckland, looking after sales for those guys. And so we were bumping to one another at the supermarket and stuff like that. And then I think in the early 2000s we got approached by a German label.
Analog.
And this young German guy had loved Fall From Grace and wanted some more, you know, said, have you got anything in the can that we could do a release with? So we dug out all the old demos that we had, and
because you only like the old stuff.
The old stuff. yeah.
I don't like the new stuff.
No. You know, yeah. Oh, when you got that guitar and you know the full band. No. So because of course, you know, the whole analog thing had swung around at that stage. So,
yeah.
But again, interestingly, he tracked us down through the internet.
It's kind of had a life of its own over in Germany.
Yeah, it has, and it's introduced, I mean, a lot of people to the band. Mark Schaefer, the guy that had the label, said, we're doing our 10-year anniversary. And at that stage, we'd done the Dance Macabre reunion on 2013, and Wes and I had sort of thought, well, we've spent all this time getting the material up to scratch. There's definitely a Macabre DNA that's happening, you know, that's still there.
Yeah.
Maybe we should just carry on and see what else we could come up with. So Ralph had, by that stage, gone back to his life in South Africa, so it was just Rod and Wes and myself and knocking around and recording and making electronic music. And David heard about that, heard that Mark was doing this 10th anniversary thing, and he was asking for either new tracks or, you know, some unreleased stuff. So Dave contacted me and said, look, why don't we just have a jam and see what we can come up with. And that was 2016, I think, and we were basically jamming once a week, regularly right through. So I, by that stage, I'd moved out of Auckland and was up north in Kaipara, and I was coming down to Auckland for a couple of nights a week. So I'd have a jam with Wes one night and a jam with Dave the following night.
Brilliant,
so
yeah.
It was a nice little sort of creative bump in the week. So yeah, that we would just basically do that. But Dave, serial gear addict, you know, he'd basically buy the newest thing or whatever had taken his fancy, have it for about a month, and then move it on.
Flog it.
Something else had come up. Quite frustrating in when you were trying to do a live show, because
yes.
You know, you'd have everything worked out for one instrument and then he'd turn up with something else, you know, you'd have to start all over again.
These days, Nigel, your career, i.e. your work, sustains you. Tell our listeners about your day job, because it's pretty much a business that you created yourself and it grew out of your job working in musical instruments.
Yeah, pretty much.
Retail.
I went early 90s, I started work at Oceania, and Oceania at that stage was a sound rental company. And as the company was getting bigger, we were buying more equipment, and to get the rider specific equipment that the international bands were wanting, we were having to go in a lot of cases direct to the manufacturers of the stuff. And they would turn around and go, well, you've bought all this, do you think you could sell some down there? And that basically became my gig, was bringing in gear and selling it, essentially. By that stage, I'd extended the sort of the brands and things that I was representing out mostly to recording type equipment and, you know, microphones and interfaces and, well, you know, how do you describe your job? If you want to put a recording studio in your basement, come and see me.
In fact, these microphones we're talking to,
yeah.
An RNZ is supplied by you.
That's right. Yeah.
You're spending quite a bit of time with Weston Prince, who you mentioned before as the guitarist in Dance Macabre. Tell us about that project called DM Redux. What is DM Redux, for a start?
Well, it's codified. So, another day is the Latin description.
Deum
Redux. Yeah. Or, of course, DM, Dance Macabre, right. Redux again. So, if you know, you know.
Yeah, too clever for your own boots,
and it's also the same. We did the same thing with the car crash set project that Dave and I were doing. So
CCS.
Yeah. So, we often referred to as just the initials, but we turned that around and put it into Spanish. So
yes,
it is.
That's beautiful. You must miss Dave.
I do.
There's quite a strong element of it's not what you get for it, it's more what you become by it as a result of your music. Is that something you would agree with?
These days, I'm not really doing it for, you know, 75,000 tracks a day are being loaded to Spotify.
That's right, yeah. I mean, why bother?
Why bother? You know, but Wes and I continue with the DM Redux thing. We have stuff on Bandcamp as the main outlet. With CCS, Dave invested, and we did a couple of vinyl releases.
Final question, as the 80s fades into the rearview mirror, Nigel, how do you look back on your catalogue of work?
Gosh. It's been, you know, it's something that we did. It had momentum at the time. I think it has merit. Fall From Grace in particular,
that's a gem. Yeah.
That's about to come out on a compilation album. There's a Greek synth duo. There's a release that they have coming out, which is all the tracks that influenced them, and we're on that, along with, you know, OMD, Michael Rota. The list of, I'm just gobsmacked by who we're sharing space with, but all my heroes.
Oh, good company, yeah.
Very much. So, yeah.
Love your work, Nigel. You're looking forward to the CCS 40th anniversary next year.
Oh, gosh. Well, we may have to do a gig.
Exactly. Many thanks for joining us on Musical Chairs program, and love to your family.
Oh, thanks, Trevor. Thanks for having me.
Talk.